Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, proposals to bring changes in Iraq. Challenges facing Singapore as it marks 50 years of independence. Choosing menus to help struggling addicts.
It could change their lives, and it's nothing really extra for the addiction clinics. It's just minor changes, but it'll definitely increase the successful withdrawal rate.
And some top singers signing on to star in a new production of The Wiz, coming up right here on The Voice of America. Facing growing demands he deal with mismanagement and corruption, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has proposed eliminating the positions of Vice President and Deputy Prime Minister as part of a series of reforms. The announcement follows weeks of protests, inconsistent electricity service, and an appeal for action by Shiite Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. My colleague Victor Beatty is following the story and joins us now here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. Thank you. The plan calls for cutting Iraq's three vice presidents, which includes Mr. Abadi's controversial predecessor, Nouri al-Maliki. It would also end party and sectarian quotas for choosing officials and reduce the number of personal bodyguards assigned to officials. Iraq's parliament must still approve the moves. The cabinet gave its backing on Sunday. Arab and Muslim scholar Amin Saikal of the Australian National University told me it's a bold move and based on two reasons.
One is that he wants to really consolidate his own position because one of the deputy prime ministers that he's dismissing his predecessor, that's Mr. al-Maliki, and Mr. al-Maliki has been a thorn on his side for long enough, and now he feels that the time has come that he should basically marginalize Mr. al-Maliki. But at the same time, let's not forget that Mr. al-Maliki does have a degree of popular support, or at least from certain groups among the Shiites, and therefore Mr. al-Abadi may not find his decision one that he could implement very easily and without any major reaction. And the second thing is that, of course, he would like to really show to the Iraqi public that he's still in charge and therefore he's capable of introducing reforms. And essentially what he really wants to do is to tell the Iraqi public that he understands their problems and he knows that the shortage of electricity and a hot summer of Iraq has caused a lot of discomfort for them. But at the same time, it is important to remember that Mr. al-Abadi does not have control over the whole of Iraq. One-third of Iraqi territory is under the control of the Islamic State, and therefore his reforms would not be really implemented in those areas. And secondly, he has to really get his reform package through the parliament, and he does have a fairly strong oppositional elements within the parliament, and whether he would be able to really get the package through as a whole, that remains to be seen. But at this point, I think one should not expect too many results from this reform package that he's announced.
Why the public anger over this situation? Is it because of the amount of corruption that grips Iraq's government?
The level of corruption is extremely high, and I think it's reached an intolerable level. The public is certainly felt it very, very strongly, and a lot of money has come in and just simply disappeared instead of being really spent on bringing about important structural economic and social reforms to the society. But then again, it all really depends also on a situation of security in the country, and the security situation is so bad that it is extremely difficult for Mr. al-Abadi to do anything more than cosmetic. And also, let's not forget that, again, his power base is among the Shia majority population of Iraq, and at the same time, it is very much tied to his good relationship with Tehran. So I think his hands are very much tied. I don't think that he's going to be more inclusive in his politics or more reformist in terms of bringing about structural changes to the social and economic spheres.
Well, Professor, the anti-corruption drive received a push a couple of days ago on Friday when Iraq's Shia cleric, the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, called on Mr. Abadi to quickly address such internal issues in government, including corruption. How important is his statement?
His statement is very important, simply because that he is one of the widely respected clerics among the Iraqi Shiites, and also he's got good relationship with Iran. At the same time, whether Mr. Al-Abadi is in a position to bring about quick reforms in the area of administration, governance, and corruption. So at this stage, I think it's more of a political statement that he's made rather than something that you could easily implement within a very short space of time.
Thank you very much, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media. Andrew, what's going on?
Well, the big trending topic today in the U.S. is Ferguson, hashtag Ferguson. Of course, 1 year ago this past Sunday, Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager, was shot by Darren Wilson, a white police officer, setting off weeks of protests and a conversation in the United States about race and about policing. So the protests and the memorials were going on again this past Sunday. And sadly, what happened was that there was another shooting. A police shot one of the protesters. And the last I heard, he's currently, I believe, in surgery. But this is kicking off a whole other firestorm. People using this hashtag Ferguson to say, we're 1 year later and nothing's changed. Other people on the other side saying, oh, these people protesting are, you know, they shouldn't be protesting. They're causing this trouble. So a lot of back and forth on that as this plays out, unfortunately.
It's a very sad situation, and it's a problem our country has to deal with.
Yeah, and it's something I don't think that can be solved in a year. And a lot of people are saying this on social media as well, is that even though it's a year past the anniversary of Michael Brown's death, this is a conversation that's going to take multiple years. So even though people are saying 2015 is no different than 2014, other people on social media are saying, give it time. We're starting the conversation. We're going to get there, but it's going to take some time.
Well, thank you, Andrew, for stopping by.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Do you like to sleep on your back or on your stomach? If so, you may want to think about some new findings from researchers at Stony Brook University in New York. The researchers discovered that sleeping on your side might help your body remove potentially harmful leftover chemical components from your brain, components that are implicated in neurological diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. The researchers studied MRI images of the glymphatic pathway, which is a complex system for clearing waste, in the brains of sedated rodents as they slept on their back, front, and side positions. The researchers found that waste transport was most efficient when the rodent slept on its side, and say that further MRI imaging research with humans is necessary. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Singapore Sunday marked 50 years of independence with a parade, fireworks, and a tribute to founding leader and authoritarian ruler Lee Kuan Yew, who died at age 91 in March. Lee's People's Action Party, which has ruled the city-state since its founding, has been both praised for its economic success and condemned for suppressing political dissent. Michael Barr, an associate professor at Finders University, who has written extensively on Singapore, says Singapore today faces many challenges.
They have neighbours that are competing with them in ways that they haven't faced before, and the world has changed. Their old method of doing business, which was essentially copied from the Japanese and the Koreans, which was to manufacture stuff and sell it, that's not working as well as it used to, and they require a more imaginative approach. Part of their problem is that they're lacking that imagination. They keep increasing the number of migrants in order to increase their inputs, thinking that that means that they can manufacture more and sell more and make more money. But that's reached the stage now on such a small island where they just can't keep doing that, because there's actually a political blowback to them and a social blowback. So that's, as a country, Singapore is now really got to face up to a new world and a sort of a new economic order, and it's a big challenge for them.
We asked if a change in government would be a good thing for Singapore.
It's not likely to see a change in government, but we are seeing changes in the political dynamics. We're seeing a dramatic increase in the levels of accountability that are being demanded of the government, and this is a good thing. But the government is holding on, and unfortunately, this new generation of ministers, the main thing that they seem to have learnt from Lee Kuan Yew is how to crack down. And they've learnt the lessons of knuckle-duster politics, and as you said in your introduction, your question, you know, they're engaging in legal actions and litigation and police actions against dissidents, instead of seriously taking into consideration the problems that are being raised by these people and the fact that these people are expressing concerns that are widespread. And this, I think, is a problem. So apart from those economic challenges they're facing, the government and the country is also facing a political challenge of how to respond to an electorate that just doesn't roll over and say, oh, you're wonderful anymore, which is what they used to do.
And what would our Flinders University professor say if he had the ear of the Prime Minister?
I think I'd have to say that he's made life much more difficult for himself by not tackling these things 10, 12 years ago when he was in power, or even 20 years ago when he was Deputy Prime Minister. These problems we're seeing now, I mean, that even the trains aren't running properly, these are not as a result of decisions that are being made in the last couple of years. They're decisions made 10, 20, 30 years ago. If they're going to be serious about opening up knowledge economy and a service-based economy, is they need to lighten their touch politically. They need to go beyond the lip service that they pay for creativity and freedom and the expression of ideas, and actually let Singaporeans have a freer hand in expressing their ideas and coming up with ideas, in saying what they think, even if the government finds that what they say is not comfortable for them. And one of the things they might say is, you're not doing a very good job. And, you know, I think we need more people in Parliament who disagree with you.
Barr expects Singapore to remain economically important because of its location, but says its reliance on gambling reflects a lessening of its traditional economic importance. Coming up on International Edition, eating and drinking to help recovering addicts, and mixing singing and acting for entertainment. Alcoholism and drug abuse, could these be linked to the foods that sufferers consume? Dr. Keith Cantor, a nutritionist, believes they are, and he joins us on the line from the southern U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia, a great town. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Oh, no, we're glad to have you. So, first of all, how are addiction and nutrition linked?
I think most of the addiction centers and rehabilitation centers are doing a great job, but they're missing the link, and here's what it is. To be addicted to a substance, you know, drugs, alcohol, is all related to our opiate receptors, which are clusters of proteins that are in our brain, our spinal cord, and our gastrointestinal tract. And research shows that people that are addicted to these substances have stimulated opiate receptors. When the opiate receptors are stimulated, they release chemicals that give the body urges. If you're addicted to a substance, the urge that they give you is to have more of that substance. So I started studying that more and more, and I found that a lot of, several different foods have the same effect on the opiate receptors. Sugar being a big one, gluten being another big one, certain milk byproducts, caffeine, nicotine, some dyes and preservatives. And what they do is they stimulate the opiate receptors. The opiate receptors releases the different chemicals that give the body the urges. Our body can't really distinguish what the urges are for, so it's whatever you're addicted to.
So should patients take more sugar, more nicotine, or should they stay away from those things?
They have to stay away from those things. So what the NAME program did is we developed menus for 5 meals a day, 3 meals and 2 snacks, for 365 days a year for the clinics and rehabilitation centers, because it really only works in a controlled environment, because they still need things like counseling, is very important, what started them to want it to begin with. If you go to nameprogram.com, I have a week's worth of menus there. And if you go to DR for Dr. KeithCantor.com, you could find lots of healthy menus, but they may not be related to what's needed for the addiction, but just regular healthy menus. If they're in a controlled environment and they're getting counseling and they're getting exercise and they're getting some relaxation and all the other parts of that the addiction centers and rehabilitations do, it gives them less urges and it increases the successful withdrawal rate from the drug. And then I allow the patients, through the clinics, they have a code so they could get the menus. I allow them to give it to the patients when they leave, so those that are willing to could follow up and keep using the different menus so they don't stimulate the opiate receptors and therefore have a lower relapse rate.
That's very interesting, and it could change people's lives.
Yes, it could change their lives, and it's just, it's nothing really extra for the addiction clinics. It's just minor changes to the menus and the beverages that they drink, but it'll definitely increase the successful withdrawal rate and lower the relapse rate of the recovering alcoholics. So we're real excited about the program, and so far it looks like the clinics that are taking on the program seem very happy with it.
Well, thank you very much, Doctor, for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Susan. I really appreciate it.
You're tuned to VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Some of the top stars of R&B music, including Queen Latifah and Mary J. Blige, have signed on to star in a new production of The Wiz. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Shauna Renee about the show and a new Miles Davis movie from Oscar nominee Don Cheadle.
We already know that Queen Latifah and Mary J. Blige have both signed on to be a part of what they are calling a live production, a live stage event that's going to air on television here in the States. Queen Latifah signed on very early on to play The Wiz, which I think is going to be very interesting.
That's an interesting choice.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, first of all, we never thought of The Wiz as being female. And Queen Latifah, as we know, is quite the presence anyway. So I am looking so forward to seeing what she does with that role. Also, Mary J. Blige is going to be playing Eveline, the Wicked Witch of the West.
Get out.
Which I think is probably, I can't imagine anyone else really playing that, because obviously this is a musical. This is based on The Wiz,
right,
which was based on The Wizard of Oz. We all know The Wizard of Oz, but it was in the context of African-American culture. And it started off as a stage play in the mid-70s, and then it became one of my favorite movies of all time in the late 70s. The stage play starring Stephanie Mills and the movie starring Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, Lena Horne. So it was a huge movie and a cultural event. So we just learned that Amber Riley, who is from Glee, she's a very popular young lady out of Glee, has been added to the cast. And what I thought was really interesting is that Uzo Aduba has been added to the cast as well. Now, many people may not know the name, but she plays Crazy Eyes on Orange is the New Black, which is a hugely successful television show. Many people know her as an actress, but do not realize that she's also played on Broadway, and she was an opera singer. She is a fabulous voice. So this will be the first time that we'll be able to see her and hear her in this form. And she'll be playing Glinda.
Wow.
The Good Witch of
the North.
North,
yeah.
Yes, of the North, yes.
Well, now, I also understand you were telling me that Don Cheadle's got a new project coming out?
Now, this is a bit different because the whole movie covers a few days in which Miles Davis disappeared into his Manhattan apartment and was reportedly haunted by his ex-wife and his glory days and images. And knowing Miles Davis, this was probably brought on by a substance or two.
A chemical or two, yeah.
But for a few days there, people were wondering where he was. What was he doing? He just went completely missing, and a Rolling Stone reporter was the one that eventually broke into the house and found him. And so Don Cheadle has been working on this project for some time, and he recently got a distribution deal with Sony. And I understand that it's going to be screened at the closing night ceremonies for the New York Film Festival, which is a huge, huge deal. And from what I understand, Don does a fabulous job portraying Miles Davis.
I definitely am looking forward to that. I'm a big fan of his. And if you're a fan of Shauna, you can send her a tweet at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA_music. You can listen for her in the Soul Lounge. That's at our website, www.voanews.com.
Thanks for joining us here on International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, recently announced a $65 million contribution to the UN World Food Program, or WFP. This will allow the organization to continue to provide emergency food assistance to some 4 million Syrians inside the country and approximately 1.6 million refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, and Egypt. The funds will help keep WFP programs operating through November and avert an imminent shutdown. The United States is the single largest donor of humanitarian assistance to the Syrian crisis, providing more than $4 billion to help millions of people inside Syria and beyond its borders to receive food, shelter, education, urgent medical care, and much-needed relief supplies. USAID has now given more than $1.2 billion to WFP for its Syrian operations. This includes more than $530 million for operations inside Syria and over $693 million for operations benefiting Syrian refugees. While USAID remains the World Food Program's largest donor for the Syria response, a lack of robust funding from the international community has forced WFP to reduce food voucher values by as much as half for refugees and lower the amount of food in monthly household parcels inside Syria. The United States continues to encourage other donors to alleviate these and other critical humanitarian needs. We urge all governments to fulfill unfunded pledges. The most recent contribution from USAID has helped WFP avoid having to make additional program cuts, including curtailing all emergency food assistance to Syrian refugees in Jordan who live in host communities, which would have begun August 1st. We have heard tragic stories of hungry refugees returning to war-torn Syria and taking children out of school to beg, said Dina Esposito, director of USAID's Office of Food for Peace. We hope this new funding will help mitigate such difficult choices and help Syrians as the winter months approach. Since 2013, the WFP voucher program, funded significantly by USAID, has provided critical food assistance to Syrian refugees while also contributing about $1 billion to the economies of Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, Egypt, and Iraq, all nations who have so generously opened their doors to refugees. Inside Syria, WFP's food parcel distributions have helped feed millions of conflict-affected people. The United States remains committed to working with international partners to help meet the desperate food needs of the Syrian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.